are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
It is Tuesday, November 28th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Assistant Professor of Education at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Mass., and Director of Research for the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Education Assessment, on his book, Beyond Test Scores, A Better Way to Measure School Quality. Also on the program today, huckster James O'Keefe accidentally helps validate pedophilia charges against Roy Moore. Meanwhile, GOP scrambles to pass a tax deal this week, may punt to next week. Budget still needs to be passed. Dem leadership just canceled their meeting with Donald Trump. Debt stealing in jeopardy. Government shutdown looms. Meanwhile, speaking of meeting, Donald Trump meets some Native Americans. It did not go well.
Oh no, it was great.
New York Times Nazi apparently used a fake name, lost his job because socialists found him out. Disarray at the State Department, and a second accuser comes out in the case of John Conyers, a former ex-staffer with contemporaneous validation of her story. And speaking of Alabama, it's now Roy Moore versus Jones versus Busby. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Like I said, Donald Trump was met with Navajo talkers. You'll recall, I think most people know this, that during World War II, one of the methodologies in communicating in lieu of like some type of code was in the Navajo language. The idea being that Germans and I guess Italians, who we were fighting against, would be very unlikely to know and speak the Navajo language. So President Trump invited them to the Oval Office to provide them with recognition. These men are obviously, there's three men who are here, at least pictured in this video. They're obviously quite old. World War II ended, to the best of my knowledge, 80 years ago, 82 years ago, I guess. And so these gentlemen are probably at least in their 80s, 90s, I would say, right? And we... Yeah.
Yeah, definitely 80s or 90s.
And here is Donald Trump trying to express just how much we appreciate their service to this country. And you might say he flubbed it a little bit. Here he is using them, using these old veterans as props in his attempt to score some extremely, extremely cheap political points.
And I have to say, I said to General Kelly, I said, General, how good, here he is right there, the chief. He's the general and the chief. I said, how good was this code talk?
You know, this is very nitpicky and not the point of the thing, but John Kelly's not a general. He used to be a general, but now he's a civilian. He's the chief of staff. He's not a general anymore. But I think it's obviously Donald Trump is not going to recognize this, but I think it's important other people do.
I admire your ability to nitpick in this time of ours.
I'm sorry. This is an important.
It is.
It's
not. I'm not.
And it's not so much that this dum-dum says it, but most other people sometimes fall into that trap. All right, go ahead. That's not
code talkers. What was it? He said, "Sir, you have no idea."
He doesn't.
You have no idea how great they were, what they've done for this country, and the strength and the bravery and the love that they had.
Pause it for one second. Now, you can also imagine John Kelly having some, as much as John Kelly may be simpatico with some of or a lot of Donald Trump's plans, he must deep down really hate the guy just because he's so odious. So you can't imagine him saying like, "Oh, President Trump, you have no idea about the code talkers." Not like you'd be really surprised to hear how important they were, but just like, "I know you have no idea because you're an idiot." Go ahead.
The country and that you have for the country. So that was the ultimate statement from General Kelly, the importance. And I just want to thank you because you're very, very special people. You were here long before any of us were here. Although we have a representative in Congress who they say was here a long time ago. They call her Pocahontas. But you know what? I like you because you are special. You are special people. You are really incredible people, and I have to, from the heart, from the absolute heart, we appreciate what you've done, how you've done it, the bravery that you displayed, and the love that you have for your country.
I like you. Do you like me?
I honestly
best part of that is he's loading it up like, "You guys have all heard this. I know this is some old material, particularly on the res, but I can't help it. Pocahontas, eh? Am I right?"
I just feel so badly for those guys.
Oh my God.
Just like,
it's like you could do a close history of like America genocide up to the present. Pocahontas, am I right?
But just like, the idea that these guys are going to the White House to get some type of recognition at this point in their lives, and they get stuck with that guy as the president. Like, and it was just like, I just want to reduce your service down to a, fairly offensive joke about somebody who I might be afraid is running against me. So, if you don't mind, let's take a moment to do that.
No, they missed out on the honor for your service.
Sort of, God, Jesus.
They just can't do it.
It's just
the basic ceremonial functionality of the job.
He's demented. Like, that is also one of those things, like, when they go for the 25th Amendment hearing. They're going to put that up there. They're going to play that video.
I think the most demented part of it is that he really clearly thinks that they're going to dig it. Like that to me was what, because when I first heard about this, it was like, "Oh, really? That, what a shock that Trump would say this when he's meeting with Native American." Like, of course he's going to say this. But the fact that on top, like, one way he could go is, "I'm just going to say this and I don't care because I'm a dick." But the way he went was like, "These are my new friends. I love them. They've been here forever. I totally get it. It's deep from the heart. I'm going to hit him with an old Pocahontas slide. They're going to love it."
Well, I mean,
he
but
waited
this is also,
for a laugh.
This is also, look. There's also something in the conservative mentality that they think they have actually convinced themselves, when they use when they want to bash Muslims by using gay rights, whenever they think that they're actually in the position of servicing. He thinks not just that they're going to think it's funny, that he's going to be seen as like a guy who's like protecting their valid claims. Against supposedly Elizabeth Warren sort of stealing their identity.
Great hotel in the sky.
I mean, just wow.
I also like how every time. Can you hear me?
Okay. Meanwhile, folks, holidays are fast approaching. And you'll recall, we are still talking about in the office. Last time we got one of those Omaha steaks, packages. Mila's now starting to ask when the tart is coming. When are the tarts coming? I don't know, sweetheart. You know, that's all they eat. Sweets now, my kids. Let me tell you about Omaha Steaks. And for only $49.99, you can get my family gift pack. This doesn't involve my family. My family is not, no, will not be coming to your house. But when you go to omahasteaks.com and enter my code REPORT in the search bar, you will get 75% off the family pack that they have put together for my listeners. Right now, Omaha Steaks is giving an exclusive savings just to you guys. Listen to everything that you'll get for less than $50. Two filet mignons, two top sirloins, two boneless pork chops, four boneless chicken breasts, four kielbasa sausages, four burgers. I'm starving. I'm starving now. Four potatoes au gratin, four caramel apple tartlets, and one Omaha Steak seasoning packet. Plus, you get four additional kielbasa sausages free. That is for $49.99. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code REPORT in the search bar, and you get a 75% savings. It's the gift that guarantees to be a hit. Make sure you put it in the search bar. Also, don't forget, and I don't know what it is, Saul will not pee on the Brooklinen sheets. Maybe we got to get another set. But he must realize they are the highest quality sheets that we have in the house. And you and your loved ones deserve high-quality bedding without needless luxury retail prices. Buying great sheets is an easy way to upgrade your nightly routine. The right sheets can make or break a good night's sleep and help you feel better and well-rested every day. Brooklinen makes quality luxury sheets and bedding accessible to everyone, and it's a great gift idea. They cut out the unnecessary markups, the retail licensing fees, the manufacturing waste, et cetera, et cetera. And they offer high-end designs and exceptional savings across their collection. Their sheets have over 12,000 five-star reviews. They were named the winner of the best online bedding category by Good Housekeeping. This is luxury bedding underpriced. You have to try these sheets today. I love my Brooklinen sheets. I've talked about them probably too much, maybe. Try these sheets, and I know you'll love them too. Brooklinen.com has an exclusive offer just for Majority Report listeners. You get $20 off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. In fact, Brooklinen is so confident you're going to love their new sheets, they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. There's no reason not to give these sheets a try for yourself or great gift. Give the gift of luxury sheets. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping, use the promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Brooklinen, these sheets are the best ever. And lastly, this is... I mean, now, you know, I mean, I go to Michigan to celebrate Christmas with the in-laws. Used to be, I didn't have to worry about Christmas at all. And frankly, I loved it. I would see people run around, they're scurrying for gifts, they're panicked, they're under pressure. I'm just waiting for my...
Sorry, Gentiles.
Days. Sorry. But how can you save some time this year? Well... what do you have on your holiday to-do list, right? How many gifts are you sending? Stamps.com can help you save time this holiday season. Holidays are almost here. You got to send cards. You got to send packages. You got to send gifts. Stamps.com. You don't have to leave your house as you're doing this. You don't have to make multiple trips to the post office. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. You buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. Then the mailman picks it up. Stamps.com makes it easy. They send you a digital scale, automatically calculates exact postage. Stamps.com will even help you decide the best class of mail every time. Print postage any day, any time of any day. Stamps.com is always open. Right now, you too can enjoy Stamps.com service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Majority Report. That's Stamps.com. Enter Majority Report on the microphone. Click the microphone. It'll open up something. Put it in there. It's a great deal. You get postage, you get 4-week trial, and a digital scale. Check it out. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jack Schneider on his book, Beyond Test Scores, A Better Way to Measure School Quality.
I made a mistake.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Assistant Professor of Education at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Mass., Director of Research for the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Education Assessment, author of Beyond Test Scores, A Better Way to Measure School Quality, Jack Schneider. Jack, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I think the last time we spoke was probably like 3 years ago about the Viagara case in California.
Mm-hmm.
And about the implications in that case was the argument that somehow there was a huge pool of really great teachers who are just not allowed to teach because of the way that the rules are set up by unions now to keep other teachers. And I think at that time you explained to us we need to do a lot more for the teachers who are there is really the point. But this book, Beyond Test Scores, I got to say, I was just back in Worcester last week for Thanksgiving. And I always have a moment, despite the fact that it's Worcester, of like, what would it be like to live here with my kids? And I checked on what Daugherty High, my alma mater, was rated, and it was like rated a 4. And I was like, oh, my God, this school has gone downhill. I mean, I never knew what the ratings were when I went. I don't even think they had them. But I was like, holy cow, we couldn't move here because like, this is the best high school in Worcester. And it's rated a 4.
And so you would never go, right? Because you would see that rating and you would never even bother to set foot in the school. So you would never actually know what the school's quality is because you, like so many people, would be looking at a rating that you assumed mapped on the reality. Unfortunately, you'd be wrong.
It was on great schools. And, you know, I didn't dig into like what their metrics were. I mean, this was a very casual thing. You know, I wasn't, the idea of moving back to Worcester is a particularly fleeting one, but I was shocked. And then, you know, your book, of course, addresses this because this is what you went through in Somerville.
Absolutely. And great schools is not alone. There are lots of other third party providers. Great schools, is a nonprofit, but of course, you know, they bring in millions of dollars from organizations like the Walton Family Foundation, which is, of course, a very strongly pro-choice in terms of charter schools organization. with a very clear ideological agenda. Other competitors are not nonprofit and are operating on an explicitly profit-oriented basis, and so they're doing whatever they can to grab eyeballs, even if it means doing things that are, you know, downright dangerous. So producing lists of worst schools, for instance, as I believe niche.com does, or maybe it's schooldigger.com. And then, of course, there's the state, which also rates schools. In Massachusetts, there are school ratings 1 through 5. Now, you know, again, if this all mapped onto reality, we'd have no problem. This would be good information that would help us all out. But unfortunately, it's primarily rooted in student standardized test scores. And so that's a lot like if we were to say that a college basketball coach is a really fantastic coach because he or she is working with the nation's best recruits who happen to have gotten, you know, private basketball coaching since they were 4 and they're all 7 feet tall, and that a coach who's working at a, you know, a little Division III college where they don't offer athletic scholarships, that this college coach would be a terrible coach, right? That's the same thing with trying to say that a school is good or bad because of its test scores. Students come into school ready or not ready to absorb lessons at age 5. So
let's, I don't want to get too far ahead of us. I mean, let's just start. Yeah. I want to just start with basically how you entered into this project, because I think this is, I think, pretty relevant. And then I want to unpack a lot of what you just said, ranging from the ideological biases and how those ratings manifest that ideology, and then I want to get into the sort of the input versus the importance of inputs as opposed to measuring outputs, or at least keeping the relationship there. But start with how you got into
this. Let me tell you how it all started. Yeah, exactly. So I live in Somerville, Massachusetts, which, for those who don't know, is for all intents and purposes a neighborhood of Boston. Highly diverse, large immigrant population, something like 80 languages spoken in the city. And when I went on the Boston Globe to fool around with one of its web tools, you know, clickbaity type tool designed to tell you the best place to live, and all I wanted was for it to tell me, I made a good decision, you should be living in Somerville, Jack, you're going to be really happy there. And it kept telling me to move to the suburbs, and that's not what I wanted to do. I couldn't figure out what was going on there until I finally dropped my concern with school quality to zero. And I said, oh, well, if you don't care about schools, go ahead and live in Somerville. And I thought, wow, this is really weird. I wonder what the rating is based on. And so I am a professor of education. I do this for a living. So I looked at the methodology, and they were using SAT scores, which are even worse than state standardized test scores in terms of measuring school quality. And so I did what any engaged scholar does. I started sending really angry tweets at the Boston Globe, and to my chagrin, they replied and said, you know, have you got a better idea? So I got sucked into a project working for free for them for a few months, where all we did, we just looked at less crazy state data and built it into a tool that, you know, was just sort of less dangerous and foolish in terms of the presentation of data. And lo and behold, Somerville schools actually looked pretty good. And we were just relying on state data. But of course, this led to broader conversations where people, you know, unfortunately, the Boston Globe called it the dream school finder. So that put me on the hook. People kept saying, you know, you think this is like the perfect way to find your dream school? I said, no, actually, you know, my original name for this tool was the less crappy use of state data tool. But obviously
not
the Globe didn't go with that. Not as catchy, right? So so these conversations led to actually a conversation with the mayor of Somerville, as well as with the superintendent at the time, who said, you know, if you were interested in trying to put together some sort of better rating system, a better measure of school quality, what would it take? And I said, the very first thing that we would have to do is actually figure out what we care about. Let's get all the stakeholders together and let's decide what we value. Right? Because nobody begins by saying, what do I care about for my kid? I only want the school to have high standardized test scores. Even if those measured learning, which they actually don't really, that isn't the sole thing that people would say. So we met with teachers and parents.
All right, so wait, hold on one second. Let me just ask you this, Jack. So the data the state has, I mean, what? Yep. Because this is this. I mean, I think this stuff is also instructive for a whole host of public policy issues that very often we have maybe an arbitrary, or maybe this wasn't arbitrary, compilation of data that makes all sorts of assumptions, like you're saying, because you can't do anything but other than, you know, use that data to create. And so what data you choose to measure automatically locks you in to a certain assumptions that you may not be aware are being made about what is supposed to be important. And then you produce, you start working with this data and it comes up with results that then sort of like skip the initial part and just move to sort of like the broader categories. So
that's a nice way of putting it.
So, all right. So tell us what I mean, do you have a sense of why, of what data was being compiled by the state, and why? Was it just arbitrary, or was it, you know, sort of irrelevant? And let's just go to step one, which is what are the important values we seek out of a school? And then how will we get data to measure that?
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, the main thing, there are two key explanations for why the state collects data on what it collects data on. The first is ease, right? This is a huge enterprise. Massachusetts is a tiny state, but we've got a million students. So what is easy to get? We can easily get, the enrollment at the school, for instance. Attendance is a little more complicated. We can get that. We can get students to sit down for an externally developed machine-scored multiple-choice test, right? That's relatively easy. We can get a lot of easy things. Then there's also the historical piece to keep in mind, which is that people are just used to standardized testing. Standardized tests have been around for 150 years, in fact. The very first standardized test was given in Boston. The fact that people are used to it makes people less likely to be skeptical, right? If there wasn't this history of standardized testing and you dropped down a Scantron multiple choice test in front of students, they'd look at you like you were nuts, and they'd go home and they'd tell their parents about it, and their parents would be outraged that this was how you were going to try to measure what their kids had learned that year. This is not the only way that we can try to measure student learning. And there are a whole host of other measures that we would probably like to have in order to figure out how's the school doing? What's life there like? So to answer your second question, what do people care about? We've organized a school quality framework into five major categories. And these represent what basically everybody really cares about. And by everybody, I mean not just parents and community members, but the students themselves. We ran focus groups where we included students. And then also teachers, district administrators, principals. And what do they care about? They care about teachers and the teaching environment. They care about school culture. They care about a school's resources. They care about the academic learning that happens at a school. And then they care about these character and citizenship and well-being outcomes at a school. With a lot of that stuff, you know, there actually is a relatively easy way to get the information. You just have to ask the people who spend 180 days inside the building. Teachers and students, a well-designed survey can actually get a lot of that. It just happens to be that policymakers historically have distrusted teachers, have not seen teachers as being a part of the policymaking process. Why would you
consider teachers to be part of this process when they're actually the ones who bridge the entire thing, to put the whole thing together? I mean, it's just absurd.
Yeah, right. It's a crazy kind of top-down approach where, you know, the belief is that measurement is something that is objective and impartial, and therefore, you know, something like a survey, a perception survey, couldn't possibly be a part of measurement. When, of course, a well-designed survey is as objective as any other sort of assessment tool. It's just that the decisions that are being made and the human input that's happening is just more obvious. But of course, there are decisions being made and human input when people are deciding what questions to put on a standardized test,
right,
when they're making the decision to give a standardized test in the first place. And so, you know, one of the messages that I keep coming back to in this work is that, you know, for 20 years, educators and many parents, increasingly parents, have been, you know, making the case loud and clear that this is a crazy way to measure school quality, and especially a crazy way to measure school quality if you're tying high stakes to it. But of course, you can't replace something with nothing. And so that's been a big part of our work, is to design a kind of alternate system so that instead of saying, let's stop the measurement enterprise altogether, because of course, people do want information about how their schools are doing. And policymakers are really after that kind of information. They're not going to give it up once they've had something, even if what they've got is invalid and unreliable. But if you give them something better and you say, listen, you're going to have all the information you wanted and more, and it's going to be more reliable, that's a pretty hard thing to say no to.
So how long did this process take, and where is this new, I guess, matrix been deployed?
Yeah, so I did 2 years of pilot work in Somerville, in part because it's a small city where a small research team could get a lot done and talk to a lot of people. And then we expanded out. We started this consortium, the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Education Assessment, that is a partnership between me and my research team, as well as with the Center for Collaborative Education in Boston. And we wanted to start small with the consortium to really get it right. But we also wanted to have districts involved that were really representative of the state as a whole, so that we could show this actually is proof of concept for a system that would work statewide and, you know, possibly nationwide. So we've got six districts, including Boston. Right now, we're starting our second year of work. There are 100,000 students in our consortium, which means that one out of every 10 students in the state is in a district that is a part of our consortium. And we're doing a lot to try to measure school quality in a way that's fairer, that's more comprehensive, and that gives people information that they can act on and minimize the kinds of crazy unintended consequences that we see if people just go on greatschools.org, for instance, and they see that a school has a 4 rating, and they're going to act on that, right? They're not going to send their kids to that school. And, of course, that is going to lead to segregation patterns that we absolutely have seen in the last 20 years, that, you know, it's particularly middle-class parents, and they tend to be white, who are consuming school quality information and making decisions about where to live and where to send their kids. And if the data they're looking at happens to reflect more about demography than about school quality, we're essentially steering them away from diverse schools and sending them out to whiter and more affluent schools. And we're exacerbating segregation in the process. So even though this work is very much about getting it right and giving educators good information, and, you know, not punishing schools that shouldn't be punished, it's also very much about a broader social justice effort to show schools in a fair light. So we're not promoting segregation.
All right. I want to get to that demography because that deals with inputs. But before, I mean, just in terms of what your experience was in Somerville, and what did you find that the could you compare ratings before and after? In other words, were there schools that went down, mm-hmm. or does it not work that way? You don't give them a number. You give them more of a give me the before and after, and
yep.
also, like, if I'm looking at two schools and I'm deciding, is it as easy as, like, oh, this one's a 7, this one's a 4, the 7's better,
yeah, right.
because it's 7.
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. So I'll tell you the both and to this story. So you could, for instance, give schools a score. Let's pretend that that's something we want to do. The before and after would be you actually do get different ratings, that what you measure has a big impact on the overall rating that you would come up with based on that measurement approach. So, you know, we did a little quantitative analysis just in Somerville because we had a couple years of data there. And we looked at what would the overall rating be for these schools if we took all the information we have and we built a kind of accountability system out of it. And what we found is that if you just rated schools and ranked them, top to bottom, that it would not match the rankings that the state had produced, right? Because we're measuring some different stuff and we're measuring schools in a fairer and more comprehensive way. It produces different ratings. But of course, the bigger question, which you alluded to, is no, you can't just give a school a 7 or a 4. That's a kind of crazy. If anybody who's been to school knows that a school is not uniformly good or bad. Right. Just because a school is good at one thing doesn't mean it's going to be good at other things. So schools are ecosystems that have strengths and weaknesses. And above all, they either fit or don't fit for particular kids. And so you really need to present a holistic picture of schools so that parents can get a sense of what is a school like overall? Do its strengths align with my top priorities for my kid? Are the weaknesses of this school something that don't really bother me or that I can compensate for at home? That's a picture that really aligns with reality, as opposed to saying, well, this school is a 4. Well, a school that's a 4 is probably not going to be a 4 across the board. It might be tremendous in particular areas that are really important to people. And its weaknesses might be things that, you know, people actually don't care that much about. So it's really important to present a more nuanced and complete picture.
I mean, this is, you know, there's two issues here, right? There, it seems to me. One is the failure of the rating system to take into account the inputs. The other is the sort of reducing a school to a single number, which I have, like, as a parent and as someone who, you know, I think I'm probably a little bit more savvy than the typical consumer of education, but not much. And I'm, you know, frankly, it's like, I don't know. Like, I can come up with an argument that my daughter needs X, but I could also come up with an argument that she needs the exact opposite of X. You know, like, I, sure, you know, she's, you know, I don't know how she'll react to this or that, which is why, you know, I like the numbers so nice, because then I don't have to think as much.
And yeah, that's right.
I wonder if that, too, also plays into sort of the ideology, because, you know, much of this is, it seems to me, it is about pushing back against aspects of the school reform movement, the so-called school reform movement in this country, which has done its best to distill down to data in a way that is contrary to, like, the concept of education. You know, that is one thing that I've noticed, is that educators, you know, the answer is, oh, you got to tell me who the student is before I can tell you what the educational program should be. And everything we see from school reform is completely different than that. It's just like there's an objective good thing and all the inputs are the same and that's it.
Yeah. And I would add one more thing to what you're saying, which is that there's also this belief that, you know, you don't need to provide parents with information because, you know, they'll somehow be able to tell a school's quality. So then we can just give them choice, right? And that parents will be able to choose a school. Betsy DeVos wants parents to be able to choose a private school if they want to. But of course, parents are really vulnerable here. They're vulnerable to marketing. They're vulnerable to mismeasurement, where they're going to look at a school from the outside and say, gosh, you know, it looks pretty new. This must be a good school. And so we absolutely need to give people good information. And you're right that the school reform movement has been obsessed with data and primarily with student standardized test scores, as if that captures reality, because it allows them to operate from the top-down level and to centralize decision-making powers, right? And to say that what we want to do is close all bad schools down and replicate good schools. Well, that's a kind of crazy thought, especially when you think of the most basic fact, which is that school quality depends on the people who are in that building, and you can't replicate that. But, you know, as you said, what are you going to do? Give parents, you know, 1,000 different data points and say, sort it out for yourselves. So surveys have shown that parents do want a letter grade or a star rating or a single score. You know, just give it a 1 to 10 score for me. But we've done some experimental work where we've given parents and other community members holistic data about schools that is just organized in a really sensible way. And then we've asked them, compared to the state system, which does give you a 1 to 5 rating, compared to the state system, how informative was this? How usable was this? How helpful was this? They give our system a higher score. We've also done experiments where we've said, use the state system to come up with your own score for this school that we've randomly assigned you. It's not a school that you know. And then in a different room, we gave people our new data system with the more holistic data, and we said, you know, give this random school a score, 1 to 5. The parents and community members working with the new data system ended up giving higher scores to schools that traditionally might receive low scores from the state because of the student demography there, right? Because you got some poor kids who are doing worse on bubble tests. And what this shows is that, you know, you don't have to reduce things down to a single number, that if you present data in a sensible, easy to understand way, people can make sense of it. We weren't working with a bunch of PhDs. We were working with just a representative sample of community members here, that they were able to make sense of it. And that when they were working with real, comprehensive, holistic, fair data, they tended not to have such prejudiced views of schools that happen to have black and brown kids, poor kids, kids with IEPs and who are getting special education, that obviously we want to avoid highly segregated apartheid schools. And that's something we want to work to change. But there are a lot of schools out there that are pretty diverse and that tend to be lower rated because they've got students who are scoring worse on bubble tests for reasons that have nothing to do with the school. So, you know, in sum, I think we can have our cake and eat it too. We can have data, and we can make it nuanced and complicated and comprehensive, and we can make it possible for average people to consume this data in a way that doesn't require them to spend hours and hours making their way through it, or, you know, some sort of graduate program in statistics. You know, we can have it both ways.
All right. Well, I think, you know, we're speaking as if everyone is fully understanding this notion about the implications of kids who are living in poverty going to school and what the implications are of that. Because and I can't remember the exact number, but and perhaps you do. But just start with what we know about kids living in poverty, starting with, I think there's I can't remember if it's a 30,000 word.
It's millions. Millions of words.
Deficit, listening deficit at age 5 or something, entering to school. Just tell us a little bit about that so that we understand the implications of what inputs are, because this is.
Sure.
And we should say, this is what folks in the school reform movement would say is bunk, and it's just a cop out.
Right.
I just want to make this a little bit more explicitly, you know, where this is in the political battle lines.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The current school reform elite would say that, you know, you're making excuses, you're letting bad schools off the hook. But of course, we have research that shows that 2/3 of a student's standardized test scores are shaped by out-of-school variables, neighborhood, family variables, right? 1/3, by contrast, is explained by in-school variables. So right there, we have a very basic fact that student standardized test scores are telling us far more about a student's home and neighborhood life than about that student, him or herself. Now let's unpack this a little bit, right? So you mentioned the number of words that a student may hear. Well, you know, let's start even earlier, right? Let's start at 0. Students who come from poverty households are more likely to be growing up in a single family home. They are therefore more likely to be unsupervised because there aren't two parents there taking care of them at all times. They are less likely to be talked to, and this is for reasons of the number of people doting on this child, but also because a student coming from a high poverty household is more likely to have a parent or parents who did not go to college. Definitely not likely to have a high income profession that is going to provide lots of advantages for this kid. And it's important that people not think of this as simply, right, that money buys the things that will produce better test scores. No, it's that money is a proxy. Money is an indicator that somebody who's got money is not always going to have a college diploma, is not always going to be in a two-parent household, is not always going to be talking more to this child. But we know statistically, on average, more likely. So this student then is in a high-poverty household, less likely to be read to. And of course, some of this stuff, you know, people might think, well, gosh, what kind of unloving parent wouldn't read to a kid every night? Well, you know, I myself am a highly loving parent and a highly educated one. And I've got to say, if I didn't know it was really critical to read to my daughter when she was 1 or 2 years old and she was more like a bobblehead than like a human, you know, she couldn't keep her eyes on the book, she wasn't listening, I wouldn't have done it. But I did it because I knew it was good for her. And eventually she learned all of these things that were really critical to her school success. She learned to focus on the book, right? That was something that came from reading to her every night. She eventually learned more words from me reading to her. She learned to be interested in books. She was desperate to learn how to read once she was about 4 years old. She had a deep understanding of not only the alphabet, but of phonemes, right? So this would be letters paired together making sounds. That means that on her first day of kindergarten, she was really ready to absorb all of the lessons that were being given to her. She's in second grade now. She's reading chapter books. She's doing, you know, complicated multiplication problems in her head, right? That is not a product of her school. That is a product of having two crazy, overeducated parents who are giving her all kinds of privileges at home. You know, then once the schooling experience begins, what we see is that some kids are more likely to be praised. They're more likely to experience school as a place where they're good at things, where they're successful. They're more likely to feel like, I am a student, I am a learner, this is something I care about and I'm good at. We see other kids, because they were less prepared on day one, are more likely to experience school as a place of flat disconnection, where they feel bad about their abilities, where they are more likely to act out and then be chastised for that. They're more likely to develop oppositional defiance to this. As a result, they're less likely to get the kind of care and support that might actually help them.
So it's like a bit of a feedback loop. I enter into school with a learning, with a deficit in terms of what I've been exposed to. I mean, even for your average parent, okay, if you have the ability, you're not working two jobs, you're there, you can read with your kid. If you have the ability to have a nanny, if you're working, as opposed to, you know, you're putting them in daycare, they're getting, you know, instead of like one out of 12 kids, they're getting one-to-one conversations on an everyday basis. And then what you're saying is that once they get to school, those deficits become self-perpetuating and there's a feedback loop. This kid's slow because they don't have this, and that projects onto the kid. The kid begins to believe I'm slow or I'm not capable of this, or I get frustrated easier because it's not coming easier to me because I didn't have this stuff 3 years ago. I mean, this is what we're dealing with. And when we reduce it down to their test scores, we're basically saying that we are not taking into consideration what the inputs are. And this is what we say with inputs. And so where is the push? I mean, I would imagine that there is that you're not creating these ratings in a vacuum. There's not only like the money maybe involved in the rating schools, but what you're doing is a fundamental threat, it seems to me, to the entire school reform movement. Because you're basically saying the foundations of that movement are based on basically lies on some level. Like your assessment of schools are wrong, and your prescriptions for those rules necessarily have to be wrong because you can't even assess what you're dealing with.
Yeah, I think the most existential threat that a work like ours poses is to the test and punish regime, right? This idea that all we need is to get the test scores and then to design accountability mechanisms that will shut down or stigmatize low-performing schools. And we can see that that is going to be especially problematic when we're talking about what we just did, which is that if two-thirds of a student's standardized test scores are being influenced by out-of-school variables and only one-third by in-school variables. And then what you're saying is, well, we're going to label these schools and we're going to take away teacher autonomy, these lower-performing schools, which we know are going to be lower-performing predominantly because of demographic variables. Then what you are essentially saying is that the schools that low-income kids attend, that black and brown kids attend, that students who have special education plans attend, that we are going to make life hell for the teachers and principals at those schools, that we're going to narrow that curriculum at those schools, that we may even reconstitute that school as a charter school, because we know that some charter schools, this is not all charter schools, on the whole, their performance tends to be about the same as traditional public schools, but some charter schools are better at getting test scores. Well, how equitable is that if we say that the only thing that we're going to do is focus on those test scores? Even if you do get those test scores even, at what cost has that been done? What else has been neglected? What has the consequence been? You know, there's some interesting research that has shown that even the charter schools that succeed in getting kids into college at higher rates often see their students drop out at phenomenal rates out of college without graduating, because so many things haven't happened for those students over the years. They got their test scores up, but they failed to do all of these other critical things, like get students really engaged in school and valuing learning and seeing themselves as capable, giving them a strong locus of control, which means that students see themselves as being responsible and actually capable of shaping their own destinies, of giving those students a full, well rounded, balanced curriculum, so they figure out what they're actually interested in and what they're good at and what they want to pursue once they get to college, right? All of these things are so critical. And so, you know, I don't think that school reform as a phrase needs to be a dirty phrase, right? This can be something that we can be proud of, but we can't pursue it in this kind of narrow way where we presume that we've got all the information we need, that this is just a matter of technical fixes, that all we need is the political will to overcome these bad old teachers, right? That is not the case. This is complicated. This is extremely challenging. And you've got 3.5 million teachers who got into this line of work because they care about kids. They aren't the enemy. So let's actually figure out how our schools are doing. Let's get some good information and let's work together to try to figure out what the actual strengths and weaknesses of schools are. Are there wretched schools out there? Yeah, not a ton of them, but absolutely. Are there amazing schools? Yes. But the typical school is a fine place for a kid to get an education, provided that it's a non-apartheid school that has extreme segregation and concentration of poverty, because those are the kinds of schools where those kids we talked about earlier, who maybe came in a little bit behind, those are the kinds of schools where teachers are not going to be able to give them the extra attention they need and the extra support they deserve, because there are going to be too many of those kids at those schools, and they're going to just fall behind together, right? So what do we need to do? We need to figure out how schools are actually doing, and then one by one, treat them as unique places with unique needs and unique strengths.
So, Jack, so let me ask you this to wrap up here. How much money has Bill Gates given you to expand this type of testing, which is going to be so helpful? Is it start with a B or an M? Let's put it that way.
Yeah, so we've been working with pretty minimal funding. In fact, the state legislature here in Massachusetts, they appropriated $350,000 to us 2 years ago, which the governor, our Republican governor, promptly vetoed, and the legislature overrode in order to get us our funds, and then he clawed back using an arcane budgetary mechanism. And then this year they appropriated $200,000, thinking that might not draw his ire, but he promptly line-item vetoed it, and the legislature overrode again, and so we're still working to get our funds. This is not a hugely expensive enterprise. It's being run largely out of the Center for Collaborative Education. We've got just a few full-time folks working on the project, and largely the work is being born by the people who are going to be affected by it. Superintendents, principals, teachers, and then we've got a lot of support from parents and community members and school boards. And I'll tell you, you know that you've got something good where your governing board makes decisions by consensus, and it consists of six superintendents Wow. and six teachers union presidents. On what planet do you have teachers union presidents and superintendents agreeing, much less coming to consensus on ideas? Everybody knows that when something is right, it's right, and when something is wrong, it's wrong, right? There, we can disagree about details, but everybody agrees that the current way that we rate schools is wrong and does damage. And, you know, we've had some productive conversations with the State Department of Education where they're saying, you know what, we're open. We're open to changing some things. There are some things we can't do, either because of political reasons right now or because of practical reasons. But, you know, a change is coming. And the people who are continuing to hold on to test scores and who want to punish schools for their test scores are really on the wrong side of history.
Arnie Duncan was on the wrong side of a lot of this, it seems to me. Maybe my assessment is wrong. But
no, you're right.
Is Betsy DeVos, and Arnie Duncan, we should say, was the Secretary of Education in the Obama administration.
Yep.
Some of that, there was enough pushback by the end of the administration that the Department of Education was sort of not leaning into the school reform movement as much as it was at the beginning. Is Betsy DeVos even engaged in this fight, or is it just really she just wants to reorient where money's going to basically private schools, to charter schools, to parochial schools? I mean, is she engaged in this at all? And I would imagine not on the right side if she was. But my sense is I don't get the sense that she's necessarily engaged in this fight.
Yeah, for her, there's a different fight, right? These are we're reorganizing desk chairs on the Titanic, if you ask Betsy DeVos, because right. for her, she wants to get rid of public education altogether, right? She has said, I don't believe in systems. I believe in individual students. She wants to empower students as shoppers who can just go around and shop for schools. Well, what do you need when you're actually trying to find a school for your kid? I mean, let's set aside all the problems here, like who's got transportation? Who's got the time to do this, right, to try to find the perfect school for their kid? Let's set aside those issues of equity, and let's say, what do you need? You need good information, and it just turns out that setting people loose in a free market is not the same in education as it is with regard to, I don't know, finding a hot dog in New York. Right, that it is an extremely complicated enterprise where it takes time for people to figure out if a school is working for their kid or not. And it takes time to figure out what's the teaching staff here like and what are relationships between teachers and students like. You know, how are students growing? How are they developing? She doesn't care about these questions. She thinks all you need to do is walk into a school, take a quick look around, you know, maybe ask your friends, and you'll figure it out. You'll be able to make a good decision. Well, you know, that just flies in the face of everything we know about trying to figure out a school's quality. And so, you know, I think the real threat here is that Betsy DeVos isn't particularly interested in trying to figure out which schools are succeeding and which schools aren't. For her, that's not a question that is relevant, right? She wants consumers to go out and figure that out. Hey, you figure out what pair of shoes you like. You figure out what kind of cereal you want to eat in the morning. You figure out what school you want to send your kid to, and that is a recipe for disaster.
Well, hopefully this stuff can happen on a state level, and hopefully Worcester's next. I would like to see a revised rating for my alma mater at Dougherty High.
We'll work on it.
Thanks. Professor Jack Schneider, the book is Beyond Test Scores, A Better Way to Measure School Quality. Folks can get more information about the Massachusetts Consortium for Innovative Education. We'll put a assessment. We'll put a link on there. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, going to head into the fun half.
Oh, do we have?
Yes, we got it. Excellent. We got it. Oh, yeah. And what better way to encourage you to become a member of the fun half than... Well, I don't want to play it quite yet. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MRHOLIDAY. You have exactly, I don't know, 16 days? 17 days? How many days are in November?
30.
Then you have exactly 16 or 15 days left to use MR Holiday. Get 30% off, get free shipping on the coffee. Great time to try out different blends. You can try out the MR blend. If you're feeling really just self-destructive and you want to try the WTF blend, go ahead. But, you know, you can get a small bag of the WTF blend, get a big bag of the Majority Report blend. JustCoffee.coop. Also, tonight on TMBS.
Mike Hanna from Al Jazeera on what's happening in Zimbabwe and Southern Africa after Mugabe's gone and the new president is in. An extended segment on net neutrality and the tax cut bill. And then Jade Hoy, who's a producer at Basketball Friends and Leverage the Chat. We're talking about monopolies and sneaker culture.
And there you go.
Of course, the post game.
You can check that out either on iTunes. Or you can see it live on our YouTube page. Also, become a member today. Join the Majority Report at jointhemajorityreport.com. Or you can give the Majority Report as a gift. What a great gift. What a great gift. Go to majoritygift.com or cucknation.org and give the gift of the Majority Report. You can do it for 1 month. You can do it for 2 months. You can do it up to 12 months. You can choose. You can do an annual membership. You can do one-time payment, whatever you want to do. So check it out. And we leave you. Wait, what's okay. I don't want to say. I want to say who it is, but then I'll be stepping on the actual song.
I think the song reveals it.
That's my point, yes. So here is today's fun half song. It is not La Poupée. Occasionally we do this, but pretty rarely. But this is just too good. And we're going to upload this. Well, we'll play it, and then we'll talk about it.
It's going to become my ringtone.
Yep.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy.
Alpha males are back. 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 Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Danarchy's song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I am
have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on! Black, come on! Black, come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. Pussy, 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 pussy.